Good morning, Hope Church. My name's Alex. I'm one of the leaders here at Hope. And it's my privilege this morning to be carrying on our series looking at challenging stories, looking at parables that Jesus told that challenge us here today. Now, the parable we're looking at this morning is all about prayer. And if there's one thing I know about prayer, it's that everybody prays. If you've been in church a long time, you'll have heard countless talks, I'm sure, all about prayer. If you were in Sunday school, you'll know that if you weren't paying attention, then all you have to say is Jesus or the Bible or prayer, and you're probably right. And even this week in community groups, we've just started a series all about prayer for 8 weeks on prayer. Even those who don't go to church will still be familiar with praying. People will pray just before a job interview or an important life decision. People will pray just before their wedding day that the weather is good, or pray when their relatives get ill. Everybody prays. John Newton, who was a famous campaigner, anti-slavery campaigner, and wrote the song Amazing Grace, actually started out as an atheist and only really shifted from that when during a storm he cried out to God, "Lord, have mercy on us." And then he started reflecting, "Well, why did I call out to a God I don't even believe in?" And that started him on his journey to faith. Everybody prays. And so with a concept that's so familiar, it would be interesting this morning as we look at this passage at what Jesus challenges us and challenges his disciples about prayer. So let's look at that this now. Luke 18 verses 1 to 8 is where we'll be starting. So let's start at verse 1. "And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, 'Give me justice against my adversary.' For a while he refused, but afterwards he said to himself, 'Though I neither fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice, so she will not beat me down with her continual coming.' And the Lord said, 'Hear what the unrighteous judge says. And will not God give justice to his elect, who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?" See, this passage is challenging us, I think, about two pretty fundamental things: perseverance and prayer. But not, I think, the kind of prayer that you say quickly before a job interview or that comes up in a storm, but more of that continual persevering in prayer, that regular, consistent, healthy prayer life. It's a pretty simple message in some ways. Always pray, do not lose heart. There it is. So I thought maybe this morning we could do a bit more of a deep dive, a bit more of a digging below the surface of this passage by going through verse by verse. And I'll be using a technique that I've taken from journalists who investigate things, which is the five W's: what, when, where, who, and why. And I'll be taking three of those and using those as the basis of our kind of exploration of this parable this morning. So the first question I'm going to ask is why. Why is Jesus telling this particular parable? I'll be asking who are actually the characters in this parable? And then finally, what? What does this parable mean for us? So let's go back to the beginnings from verse 1. We're going to go through verse by verse and ask that first question: why? Why is Jesus telling us this parable? So verse 1 again says, "And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart." So this passage starts by Jesus telling them, it starts with Luke, rather, sorry, telling us what Jesus is trying to achieve. It starts with it just being laid out what's trying to be achieved here. And yet the question that I think arises in my mind when I look at this is, well, if he's wanting to tell them something so they don't lose heart and they always pray, is he worried that they will lose heart? Why would he feel the need to have to encourage them to not lose heart and to always pray? And actually, we find the answer to that in the previous chapter. Sometimes the Bible, because of the verses and the chapters that are in it, which are helpful for reference, can sometimes obfuscate a little bit where things really begin. So actually this story really begins, I think, in chapter 17 in verse 20. In verse 20, the Pharisees ask Jesus, "When is the kingdom of God coming?" To which Jesus replies, "It's here. I'm ushering in the kingdom. It's in me." But then he goes on to explain to his disciples what will happen when Jesus returns, when the Son of Man comes back. He basically explains to his disciples that, yes, I am ushering in the kingdom now, the kingdom that is, but there's also an even greater kingdom that will be when I return, when everything will be made right, when justice will reign. And so he says to his disciples in verse 22 of chapter 17, "The days are coming when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it." So he's saying to his disciples, the challenge is that you are here in the kingdom that is, that I'm ushering in, but you won't see and you won't know when it's coming, when the final kingdom is ushered in, when I return. And of course, the disciples would want Jesus to return. He's promised them such great things when he returns. All things will be made right. All injustice will be swept away. And of course, he's told them actually that their faith will cause them to suffer, that their faith, for their faith, that they will have to bear burdens, and it will be a real challenge. And we see that borne out in the early church, in the persecution that they suffer. So today, when we hear this, we have the same mindset, I'm sure. We want justice to come back and reign. We want Jesus to be with us again. And how much more must our brothers and sisters in other countries who are persecuted really badly for their faith, how much more must they hear this and think, "Yes, Lord, I want that to happen"? But you see, Jesus says that the Son of Man will return, but we won't know when that will be. And that's the challenge. That's, I think, the crux of why he feels he needs to encourage his disciples here and encourage us. Sometimes I go running. Not as often as I should, but I do. And sometimes I run along the Greenway, which is just a big long path. Starts over here in Beckton, East Ham area, all the way through to Stratford. And so when I'm running on the Greenway, I'm not fit enough to get to Stratford and back yet. I'll start running and I'll be running and running and running. And then at a certain point, I'll decide, you know what, when I hit that point, that's when I'm going to turn back and run back home. But for some reason, psychologically, when I turn around and start running back home, I get a renewed energy, a renewed motivation. For some reason, I'm more motivated when I'm running back home than when I'm running away from it. And I think the reason for that is because when I'm running back home, I can see exactly how far I've got left to run. I can see it coming. I'm running and home is getting closer and closer and closer. When I'm running the other way, I don't know at that point necessarily exactly when I'm going to stop. And I wonder if that is a little bit of how the disciples are going to be feeling. That's what Jesus sees the disciples feeling, that they'll be running the race, but they won't know when exactly it's going to end. They won't know exactly when they'll be with Jesus again. And that's a tough place to be. And so that, I believe, is the context. That is the why. To why Jesus tells this parable. Because his disciples are in this place between the kingdom that is and the kingdom that will be. And so Jesus wants to say, keep going, persevere, don't lose heart, always pray. So that, I believe, is what Jesus is starting with when he's coming to this parable. This is the context to why he would tell this parable for his disciples and for us to hear. So let's move on to the who. We've covered the why Jesus would tell this parable and feel the need to encourage his disciples to keep going and to not lose heart. But let's look at the who. So as we begin, let's go through the passage from verse 2. It says, Jesus said, "In a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man." So we've got the first character in our story, this judge, this unjust judge. And it tells us, doesn't it, that he doesn't care what God thinks or what men think. He can't be won over by appealing to his faith or his fear of God, and neither can you appeal to his reputation or to his moral compass. And when looking into this, I found that actually this description of him is quite similar to the description of many wicked and evil characters in the ancient world at the time. And in fact, you could even draw direct parallels between what this man values or doesn't value and what Jesus says are the most important values. What does Jesus say the two most important commandments are? To love God and to love each other. And this man doesn't care about God and doesn't care about his fellow man. He's literally the antithesis, the opposite of Jesus and what he stands for. Sadly, I think people like this exist today. You know, plenty of people in positions of power, people who may even want to start a European Super League maybe, but we know there are people all over the world who have positions of authority who abuse it. Not just judges, but people in all kinds of positions of authority. And so often the injustice in the world is caused by, sadly, such people. This is our first character. We have the unjust judge. So let's carry on in verse 3. And it says, there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him, to the judge, and saying, give me justice against my adversary. So we have our second character. We've got the unjust judge. And now we have the widow, or often labelled as the persistent widow. Now, we don't know exactly what kind of justice she's seeking, but we do know from the Old Testament that the widow is one of those archetypes that the Jewish culture should really be looking after, one of those people that the Jewish culture should really be valuing. Deuteronomy 10, 18 says, the Lord executes justice for the fatherless and the widow. Psalm 82, verse 3, give justice to the weak and the fatherless, maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Isaiah 1:17, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless and plead the widow's cause. So you'd expect within that culture someone to do something. It's a very male-dominated culture, and so you'd really expect a male relative to have helped this woman out, a father or a brother or a son, someone to get her back on her feet or even go with her to the courthouse to help her plead her case. But no one is mentioned. So we can just presume this widow was alone. And there's no state system. The employment structure, again, is very male-dominated, male-orientated. And so, really, this woman comes with nothing but her persistence. So I think this story really, as readers who hear it for the first time, is set up to be a bit of a tragedy. It's set up to show this judge who doesn't care what people think, who doesn't care that the widow should be looked after, and this widow who has nothing really to offer, who's powerless before this judge. And yet, the question is then, well, who wins? Who wins? Is it the judge's corruption or is it the widow's persistence? Well, then as we read on from verse 4, it says, for a while he refused. But afterwards he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice, so she will not beat me down by her continual coming. Wow, what a victory. When we think of victories in the Old Testament, we think of David and Goliath. What an incredible upset. But this one is perhaps even more so, because it's not a single stone to the head. This is just a tap, 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 until the judge relents. What an incredible win. Then Jesus does something quite rare here, which is that he then starts to interpret his own parable. Often Jesus would just tell a parable and we can normally infer for ourselves what it means. But in this case, he specifically then explains and interprets what it is he's just said. So verse 6, and the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. And will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? You see, I think there's the characters in the story, but then there's also the underlying characters who are not mentioned that Jesus is bringing up here, namely God and his elect, which is us. Jesus really is explaining and making it clear that who God isn't, but who we are. You see, of course, God is not the unrighteous judge. In fact, we've already covered that the judge is the opposite of God. He's almost used as a parallel to show even the opposite end of the spectrum to God. So we should hear this and think, wow, our God is a God of justice. Our God is a God who, as we've seen, cares about the needy, cares about the widow and the powerless. And so, wow, how much more would God listen to us? So God isn't the unjust judge, Jesus is saying, but we are the widow. We are powerless. We are in need, aren't we? We need God. We need God's justice. We as Christians are in this state, aren't we, of waiting for Jesus to return. And sometimes it feels like we're hammering on the door of God saying, please, Lord, hear us. But the wonderful thing is that unlike the unjust judge who doesn't care, we know that our God does care. He calls us his elect. If we need to highlight it, if we need it highlighted more in Romans 8, verse 31 to 33, it says, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. I talked before about kind of motivation and how hard it can be to persevere. Well, here's a reminder, and here's the motivation we need. Our God is not an unjust judge. He is the most just judge. And in the person of Jesus, we know that he cares for us so deeply. As it says in Romans, God is the one who justifies. God didn't even spare his own son. That's how much he cares for us. And yet this widow would still keep tapping on the door and still speaking to this judge, even though by all the kind of setup of the story, we wouldn't expect the judge to do anything. Yet this widow still kept at us. So how much more should we still have a continual dialogue with God when he does care and we know he is righteous? Just like the widow, we have nothing to offer. We have nothing to bring to the table, but God is a God who listens. And we are the widow, but make it clear, God is not the unjust judge. So we've had a look at why Jesus would tell this story, and now more who is in the story, the characters in it, and also us and who and God and who we are or God is not in the story. So let's finally end with that question of what does this parable mean for us? And I just want to quickly firstly say something that it's not what it doesn't mean. Because you could easily read this passage and think, this passage is basically saying, if we just hammer on at God, if we just keep asking God, we'll always get what we want. It's almost like a blank check that he would write if we just keep asking him. Well, let's see how Jesus ends the parable, because I think it helps us to really understand what the challenge is Jesus wants from this story. So verse 8, I tell you that he, God, will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? It ends with a promise and a question. A promise that God will give justice and a challenging question about faith. So just quickly dealing with the promise. What does it mean that he will give justice to them speedily? Do you remember the context? Do you remember how it all starts? It starts with Jesus talking about the coming of the Son of Man, his second coming, the kingdom of God being ushered in full. And so when he talks about justice, that's what Jesus is talking about here. He's talking about God bringing the kind of justice that is forever. It doesn't mean that in every situation, as much as we would love it to be the case, I mean, every situation, if we just pray enough for the right things, then God is going to give that to us. But it does mean that one day there will be justice. Justice will reign. But now let's focus on the challenge that Jesus gives here. He asks, will he find people who have remained faithful? That is, will he find people who have listened and have persevered and continued praying, who have not lost heart and always pray? John Piper describes the relationship between faith and prayer like this. I found it really helpful. It said, "Faith is the furnace of our lives. Its fuel is the grace of God, and the divinely appointed shovel is prayer." I'll say that again. Faith is the furnace of our lives. Its fuel is the grace of God, and the divinely appointed shovel is prayer. I think that's what perseverance in prayer looks like. It's that continual shoveling of God's grace into our life, that continual reminder that God is the good judge, that when God comes again, we will receive justice. But what does that look like practically? Well, there's just two practical ideas I had. I mean, there's plenty out there, but here's just two, I think, two healthy ways that you can persevere in having a healthy prayer life. One is, I would say, is to keep it short. I think all the bad examples of prayer in the Bible are when people overcomplicate and make prayer something that it's not. You see the worshippers of Baal, and they're trying to get their God's attention. They're like cutting themselves and wailing. And Paul talks about in Colossians these people who puff themselves up and pray to angels and do all kinds of things. But what does Jesus say about prayer? Well, in Matthew, just before the Lord's Prayer, he says this, Matthew 6, verse 7. "And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think they'll be heard by their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask." You don't have to spend hours and hours praying. You don't have to think in your head, it has to be minimum of 15 minutes of prayer before it becomes legitimate. No, just keep it short. God knows our heart. You know how long the Lord's Prayer is? It's 5 verses. Jesus gives us his template for prayer, and it's just 5 short verses. So just keep it short. When you're in the shower, just say a quick prayer. When you're walking down the street on your way to work or just going for a walk, just say a quick prayer. When you see something beautiful, pray. When something difficult happens, pray. But just keep praying. And if you really don't know what to say, just say the Lord's Prayer. Jesus told us a way we can pray. Just say the Lord's Prayer. I find personally that if I start saying the Lord's Prayer, if I can't express myself and I start saying the Lord's Prayer, I'll often stop at a point and go, yeah, that's what I need to be praying for. I'll say, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come." Yes, Lord, that's what I want, Lord. I just want things to be right. I want your kingdom to come. Or I'll say, "Forgive us our sins as we forgive others." Yes, I need to forgive that person. I need to forgive them. "Give us this day our daily bread." Oh Lord, yes, I'm so in need of your provision and your protection. Just say the Lord's Prayer. If you don't know what to say, say the Lord's Prayer. And I'm sure that God will work on your heart and there can be more to say. Or just repeat the prayer over and over. We have that template there. So just keep it short. I think little and often is a great way to maintain a healthy prayer life. So keep it short. And the other thing I would say, the other bit of more practical advice is just keep it steady. If you ask any football fan what the greatest achievement in modern times is, they probably wouldn't say specific one-off games or one-off moments, but they'd probably say it was Leicester City winning the Premier League in 2016. This was a team at the start of the season who were 5,000-1 odds to win, who were up against teams much more wealthy with much better players. But they went on and they won a whole league season. And the incredible thing about it is that they did so across a whole season of game after game after game after game. The most incredible story in recent years in football is not a one-off moment, but it's again and again and again, a persevering of staff and players and all kinds of people just working hard week after week until they won. And I think that's what our prayer life should be modelled on. We shouldn't be looking at it as a one-off thing. I mean, having a great night of prayer is wonderful. Don't get me wrong. If you have a wonderful night of prayer, amazing. But what does that mean if you have a great night of prayer and then you spend the next week or two just not praying at all? You see, Leicester didn't win the league by winning one game 10-0. They won games 1-0, 2-1. 3-2. They got draws. They lost some games, but then next week they came back stronger and they carried on again, winning. But there's little wins. And that's what I would say our prayer life should be like. It should be a steady, consistent prayer life. I think if we want a healthy prayer life, then I think what we do is we just take it day by day. If you've had an amazing night of prayer, great, go again. If you've not prayed for days or even weeks, now's the time to start. You can start now and start again. Just take it day by day. I think our prayer life is a bit like running a race, isn't it? And if you're running a marathon and you try and sprint for the start, then you're going to be puffed out and you're probably going to stop. And anyone who's run a long distance will say, you just need to keep going. And sometimes you get in renewed energy and you go a bit faster, and sometimes you get a bit puffed out, so you go a little bit slower. But it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And our prayer life is a marathon. It's something we should be cultivating continually, just little by little, short and steady prayers. I know that I used to pray for a little bit before I used to go to work, before everything happened with COVID. My pattern became, I would pray on my walk to the bus stop, which was a couple minutes at most, and then I'd read my Bible on the bus. And it was hard at first, but then it just became natural, became normal for me to do. So perhaps one thing I would say is that if you've got a routine that you do, why not work prayer into that routine? If you go jogging or walking, work prayer into that part of your routine. If you meet up with friends, or let's say you meet people online, you play video games with friends every week, why not work into that routine that you pray every time just before you do that? If you work prayer into your daily routines, you can make prayer a part, a more of a steady part of your life. You know, we pray before meals at home. Maybe I should be praying as I'm cooking the meal. Maybe I should be praying in other ways. If I pray in the shower, why don't I do that every day? I pray in the shower. So just work prayer into your routines. I think that's just a great way to keep it steady. So finally, in conclusion, we looked at why Jesus told this parable. We looked at who is in the parable and what it means for us. Have you noticed that the ending of things often stick in your mind the most? The ending of films or books or TV shows often are the thing that can make or break our experience with it. And it often sticks with us, doesn't it? Well, one thing that's interesting is if you look at a lot of the New Testament letters, a lot of them, when they get towards the end, before Paul or whoever's writing it finally says, God's grace be with you and etc. Just before the end, he'll often say to people to the effect of persevere and pray. In Ephesians, he says, praying at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints. In Colossians, it says, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. In 1 Thessalonians, it says, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, give thanks in all circumstances. It often ends by saying, just keep on going, keep praying, pray without ceasing, pray always, pray at all times. So that's just how I'm going to end it this morning, is with just a very similar encouragement to you to just always pray and do not lose heart. Why did Jesus tell this parable? But because he knows how hard it is to keep going while we wait for him to return. Who is in the parable? Well, we've got the unjust judge, who is nothing like our God, who is so good and so just. And the persistent widow, who is just like us, in how powerless and how in need of justice we are. And what does it mean? Well, it means that prayer is the key to keep on in our faith, to keep shoveling prayer, to keep running that prayer marathon. And when Jesus returns and asks us who remained faithful, we can say, I, Lord. See, whatever place you're at today, whether you're at a spiritual high or a spiritual low, whether you've prayed this morning already or you haven't prayed in days or weeks, we can start afresh, we can go again. So Hope Church, let's always pray and do not lose heart. Always pray and do not lose heart.